Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Russia denies reports that its forces attacked a railway station in Ukraine, killing 50 people. It says the Ukrainian military was responsible for the strike. Iran supports Palestinians' legitimate right to fight against Israel's aggression, emphasizing that resistance is the only way to liberate the occupied territories. Also ahead, Pakistan's prime minister accepts a Supreme Court ruling against dissolution of the parliament, insisting that he is the victim of a regime change conspiracy by the U.S. Thank you for joining us. Russia says the Ukrainian military conducted the deadly attack that hit a railway station in the country's eastern city of Kramatorsk.
Today, on April 8th, the Ukrainian military struck the railway station of Kramatorsk with a Tochka-U missile. Tochka-U missiles, which remains were found near the railway station, are used only by the Ukrainian military.
Russia's defense ministry also says the missiles were launched from a territory in Donbass, which is fully controlled by Ukrainian forces. Kyiv, however, says Russia carried out the attack on the train station. A U.S. defense official also says the Russian military used a short-range ballistic missile to strike the site. The attack killed at least 50 people and injured many more. The railway station was packed with civilians trying to flee the Donbass region. The 45-day war in Ukraine has displaced over 11 million people. China has warned of, quote, serious consequences of Russia's suspension from the UN Human Rights Council. It says the move will simply fan the flames of war in Ukraine. Listen.
The drafting process of the relevant resolution was not open or transparent, nor did it follow the practice of going through consultations of all member states and heeding views extensively. This way of doing things will only aggravate the division among member states, intensify contradictions among the parties concerned, and add fuel to the fire, which is not conducive to de-escalating the conflict, still less pushing for peace negotiations. To handle the issue of membership of the Human Rights Council this way will set a new dangerous precedent, further intensifying confrontation and induce a still bigger impact on the UN governance system with serious consequences.
Zhao Lijian also stated that China is against politicizing human rights to pressure other countries. The Chinese official cautioned against what he called a selective approach toward the issue of human rights. This after the UN General Assembly voted to suspend Russia from the Human Rights Council. China was among the 24 countries against the U.S.-initiated motion. Meantime, Moscow has labeled the vote illegal and politically driven. Russia stands accused of human rights violations and abuses in Ukraine, but the Kremlin denies the accusation. The European Union is adding more than 200 individuals to its blacklist of sanctions against Russia over its military operation in Ukraine. The list includes two daughters of the Russian president, as well as top businessmen, politicians, and military staff close to the Kremlin. The sanctions also target officials from Luhansk and Donetsk in eastern Ukraine. The restrictions include asset seizures and travel bans in the EU. The bloc has sanctioned around 700 people linked to Russia and slapped tough economic sanctions on the country since it moved on Ukraine. In response, Moscow has announced retaliatory measures against European countries. Iran says fighting the Israeli regime is a legitimate and clear right of Palestinians in self-defense. Tehran says international bodies should prevent the regime from committing further atrocities against the Palestinian people. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh says resistance is a response to the repeated crimes and atrocities of Israel against Palestinians and their sanctities. Khatibzadeh says Israel's daily crackdown, killing, and open terrorism is the root cause of all instabilities in the occupied territories. The spokesman says the only solution is holding a referendum with the participation of all original residents of Palestine. He also says resistance is the only way forward to force the Israeli regime to accept such a democratic solution. Khatibzadeh made the remarks after the recent Palestinian retaliatory operations against Israel.
After an hours-long manhunt throughout Tel Aviv, Israeli forces clashed with Raad Hazem and killed him in Yaffa. 28-year-old Raad Hazem from Jenin refugee camp in the north of the occupied West Bank was the Palestinian man who opened fire in Dizengoff shopping street in central Tel Aviv Thursday night, killing two Israelis and wounding nine others. The Palestinian resistance groups praised the operation, describing it as heroic. Hamas resistance groups said it proves resistance is continuing and escalating, while the Islamic Jihad said the operation confirmed how fragile the Israeli regime is.
The assassination of any Palestinian, Tel Aviv's crimes, and aggression on Al-Aqsa Mosque is responded by more heroic operations. So it's a natural and legitimate response. Israel must expect that any future steps or crimes would definitely drag such reactions.
Following the operation, more than 1,000 police officers joined a manhunt, while the Israeli settlers were ordered to get off the streets and remain at home. Experts say the operation that was the latest string of deadly operations across the occupied territories and the fourth in 2.5 weeks had confused the Israeli regime and proved its weakness.
This operation in particular has really shocked the Israeli society, and the Israeli regime is broken on all levels, even the security level, because they deal with the Palestinian as a security problem and not people having political and historic rights. This operation is telling them that Palestinians exist as real owners and they have a right in these lands.
Meanwhile, Israeli military has declared its forces will be on high alert in Al-Quds for the first Friday prayers of the holy month of Ramadan. The Israeli police bolstered their forces in Al-Quds, and more troops have stationed on the numerous checkpoints in the occupied West Bank, imposing more strict measures against the Palestinians. Palestinians say the Israeli military thought its crackdown and aggression following the March 22nd operation that claimed four Israeli lives led to a state of calm in the occupied territories. However, Raad Hazem's Thursday attack that killed two more Israelis reminded the regime that the entire Palestinian lands are occupied and that the resistance continues. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
China says the U.S. is to blame for the, quote, crisis over Iran's nuclear program and must therefore promptly make the political decisions to revive the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian said Washington must actively respond to Iran's legitimate concerns. He said there is no better alternative to the JCPOA and talks on its restoration have entered the final stage. Zhao said all parties have reached consensus on most of the final text, with a few items yet to be resolved. The JCPOA removed sanctions on Iran in exchange for limits on its nuclear program. But it was left in tatters after Washington unilaterally lifted in 2018. Iran and the other remaining parties to the deal, including China, have over the past year been holding talks in Vienna to restore the agreement, with the U.S. indirectly involved. The negotiations have stalled in the recent past. Journalist and author Daniel Azar explains how the U.S. has constantly been impeding efforts to resolve the standoff over Iran's nuclear program. Let's take a listen.
First of all, it was the U.S. which unilaterally withdrew from the agreement in 2018. So that's obviously, it's at fault for that reason. And the other reason is the U.S. continually raises non-nuclear issues, such as having to do with the Revolutionary Guards, which have nothing to do with the JCPOA, or should have nothing to do with the JCPOA, that are totally extraneous to the agreement. But the U.S. raises them anyway. So therefore, I think in this way, the U.S. has essentially placed two roadblocks in the way of the treaty. I think the odds are extremely great against the U.S. approving this treaty. Opinion is against it in both houses of Congress, and I think it would be a huge political risk for Biden, especially considering that he's facing such a difficult fight in terms of the incoming midterm elections, which will take place in just 6 months. And I think the Biden administration is really on the ropes, and I can't see it taking any risks when it comes to the JCPOA.
Iran says the blockade by the Saudi-led coalition on Yemen should be lifted completely to allow humanitarian aid to be sent to the country. Iran's foreign minister also says Tehran supports the UN-brokered truce between Yemen's Nasrallah movement and the coalition. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the comments in a phone call with his Kuwaiti counterpart, Sheikh Ahmed al-Sabah, also said the truce will hopefully pave the way for intra-Yemeni talks. The two-month ceasefire went into effect on April the 2nd. It covers all offensive operations. The deal also allows for resumption of fuel shipments to Yemen and commercial flights in and out of its capital, Sana'a. However, the Ansarullah movement says the Saudi-led coalition has repeatedly violated the ceasefire. Pakistan's prime minister has accepted a Supreme Court ruling that he acted unconstitutionally by dissolving the parliament prior to a no-confidence vote he was likely to lose. Imran Khan says he was disappointed by the verdict that the National Assembly can go ahead with a no-confidence vote. Khan says he is facing what he calls a U.S.-backed regime change conspiracy. He says he would not recognize an opposition government if it succeeds in an attempt to oust them. The prime minister has accused the opposition of buying support in the assembly. He says they have conspired to oust him because of his opposition to the U.S. foreign policy. Washington has denied any involvement. The National Assembly will sit Saturday to decide Khan's fate. Muslim voters have swung French elections in the past, and they appear set to play the same kingmaker role this April. After 5 years with President Emmanuel Macron, few Muslims believe he is a quote, centrist anymore, and many are even prepared to vote for the far right. Rami Mazahiri reports from Paris.
As voters go to the first round presidential polls this weekend, many French Muslims no longer see Emmanuel Macron as the centrist which he claimed to be in 2017. If Nicolas Sarkozy introduced Islamophobia and François Hollande made it acceptable to the mainstream, Macron's term institutionalized Islamophobia. Macron immediately took Hollande's multi-year state of emergency and legalized it, with Muslims the clear targets and practically the only victims. His so-called anti-separatist law of 2021 tried to ban the hijab for minors and clearly violated constitutional protections for the freedom of association, worship, and politics. It was so heavy-handed, even the United Nations and English language media widely criticized it.
Emmanuel Macron lance son projet sur le séparatisme.
When Macron launched his anti-separatism law, which hurt Muslims so badly, it was a clear bid to join the far right. We saw that he was using their same ideas and preferred methods, and that he was doing it in broad daylight.
In the months preceding the election, nearly 100 mosques have been raided, with at least 24 shut down so far. Top Muslim NGOs and local community centers have also been exiled or closed. A new report revealed that these closures were based merely on secretive evidence, which is to say no evidence was ever produced in court.
His government has produced so much nonsense, like when they said having a beard was a sign of being a radical Muslim or taking Ramadan seriously. His politics are clearly identity politics, and that's a real danger. His objective is to have a seat at the table with the other far-right politicians.
Not apologizing for massacres during the war against Algerian independence, keeping the Arab Nelson Mandela, Georges Ibrahim Abdullah, in prison, enacting legislation which falsely equates anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism, gutting social services and help for poor, largely immigrant areas. Many Muslims say they are prepared to vote against Macron in the second round, whomever the candidate. In 2012, 93% of over 2 million Muslim voters picked Hollande over Sarkozy, providing the decisive margin in an extremely tight contest.
In 2022, Muslims may play a similar role of kingmaker, but it's still not sure which side they will pick. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Turkey was long spearheading efforts to bring those involved in the brutal assassination of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi to justice. Turkey has taken a U-turn on the case, surprising many who were hoping for some kind of punishment for the culprits.
The world will never forget the gruesome killing of outspoken journalist Jamal Khashoggi by a Saudi hit squad in 2018. Khashoggi was strangled at the Saudi consulate in Istanbul and then dismembered by a forensic scientist who worked for Saudi intelligence. The killing was caught on listening devices planted by Turkish intelligence. The Saudi dissident's body was then cut to pieces and taken to the Turkish consul general's residence, where it is believed to have been burned. No remains have ever been found. The brutal murder severely strained ties between Ankara and Riyadh and led to an unofficial Saudi boycott of Turkish exports. It cut Ankara's exports to Riyadh by 90%. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan was particularly vociferous in his condemnation of the Saudi government. He said Khashoggi was killed in cold blood by a death squad sent from Riyadh, and that it had been established that his murder was premeditated. The Turkish president said the operation had been ordered at the highest levels of the Saudi government. His assessment was supported by a U.S. intelligence report which said Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had personally approved the assassination. There has been almost no doubt that the order to kill came from very high up in the Saudi government. And Turkey was widely seen as the most unrelenting force behind efforts to bring those responsible for the assassination to justice. But Ankara has suddenly changed course. On Thursday, a Turkish court halted the trial of Saudi suspects and transferred the case to Saudi Arabia.
Well, that's your world news for now. Stay tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
A Norwegian oil company wants to drill 73 million barrels a year off the coast of the Canadian province of Newfoundland and Labrador, the equivalent of adding 7 million gas cars to the road. Here we present you an article in this regard, written jointly by Connor Curtis and Zipporah Berman, under the heading, "The World is on Fire. Why is Canada considering massive new oil drilling?" The article was published by The Guardian Daily. Please stay tuned. Coal and other fossil fuels are choking humanity. Those were the words of Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General of the United Nations, in response to the sobering recent International Panel on Climate Change IPCC report, which warned that the world has a small window remaining to act before irreversible and catastrophic impacts are locked in. People around the world are already paying the price with their lives and livelihoods. In 2021, the 10 biggest extreme weather events cost $170 billion in damages. Last year, the International Energy Agency and IPCC both confirmed that in order to stay below 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming, the expansion of oil, gas, and coal projects must stop and a planned winding down of both production and emissions begin. Yet according to the UN Environment Program's Production Gap report, the world is on track to reduce double the amount of fossil fuels that can be burned on the planet. Canada and Norway are two of the world's biggest fossil fuel producers. While the two countries have demonstrated leadership in terms of putting a price on carbon pollution and getting rid of coal plants, they share a major blind spot when just it comes to oil. Despite the IEA's finding that no further reserves of oil can be developed if we are to meet global emissions targets, both countries have plans for expansion. Case in point, a Norwegian company, Equinor, is now proposing a giant oil drilling project called Bay du Nord off the coast of the Canadian province of Newfoundland and Labrador. The project is estimated to produce up to 73 million barrels a year, which is equivalent to adding more than 7 million gas-powered cars to the road. This calls into question the Canadian federal cabinet's commitment to climate action and risks local ecosystems and the fisheries and other industries that depend upon them. Bay du Nord would involve building the deepest production wells drilled in Canada. According to estimates by Equinor, a wellhead blowout at this location would take 18 to 36 days to cap. The new Canadian cabinet was supposed to make a decision on whether or not to accept this project by March 6th, but has now delayed that decision by another 40 days, time we hope that they will use to plan a just energy transition instead of another oil project. This is the first test of their climate leadership and threatens their claims of being environmental champions. The fossil fuel industry will make many attempts to frame this project as an issue of Newfoundland and Labrador's economic interest. This is not the case. Recent polling shows that the majority of people in the province want a green economy. In St. John's, a city with a population of only about 100,000, have joined demonstrations calling for climate action and protests extended well beyond the capital of the province. Newfoundland and Labrador is also directly in the path of many severe climate impacts, and the fossil fuel industry cannot provide a long-term economic future for the province. A just transition for Newfoundland and Labrador is a win for the world and for the province, but it will need the support of the federal and provincial governments to happen. action is underway in other jurisdictions, and Canada risks being left behind. 11 countries and substantial governments have launched the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance, committing to no new expansion of oil and gas. Other leaders are acting as well. 2,800 scientists, 101 Nobel laureates, and 170 parliamentarians from 33 countries, including many from Canada, have endorsed the principles of a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty to end expansion, wind down existing production, and scale up the shift to clean energy and low-carbon technologies. Conor Curtis and Tezipora Berman wrote, "It's time for Canada to stop adding to the problem and put our political and financial resources into building renewables and electrification at a scale to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. Canada has already committed to stop financing oil and gas internationally, making it hypocritical to then support more oil and gas development at home." After the Russian special operation in Ukraine, there has been a shameful attempt by fossil fuel proponents in Canada, seemingly echoed by the premier of the Newfoundland, to justify Bay du Nord as an answer for ending dependence on Russian fossil fuels, even though the project would take years to be operational and would have no impact on the immediate situation. These arguments by oil lobbyists and the premier ring particularly hollow as European countries now look to speed up a transition away from fossil fuels altogether, which would leave long-term projects like Bay du Nord even less economically viable than they were to start. Ukraine's own delegate to the IPCC has publicly criticized the world's continuing dependence on fossil fuels as a cause of continuing wars that will only make climate change worse. In a world facing increasingly severe climate impacts that threaten the lives and livelihoods of millions of people and which will help drive future conflict, the fossil fuel industry not only cannot help provide global security, but is instead a continuing detriment to it. Let's be clear. There is no such thing as clean oil, no matter how environmentally friendly or unfriendly the extraction process. It's still oil, and it will still make climate change and the global situation worse. Canada's government has a unique opportunity to make a real impact on climate change and honor calls for change from within Newfoundland and Labrador by rejecting the Bay du Nord project and committing to a clean energy transition. This includes coming up with a plan to support oil and gas workers to shift into clean energy opportunities and other sectors, wasting time, effort, and public funding to further entrench Canada's economic dependence on fossil fuels is the opposite of Canada's climate commitments.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen, the loyal audience of IRB English Radio, welcome to another episode of everyone's favorite Back to Reality. Wherever you are, at home, at work, at any corner of the world, I hope everything is just fine with you and you're doing well. Well, this is Asma once more. I'm super happy to be at your service as your host, and here with me, I have two very dear guests. So, wish you a joyful month. Well, now let's move to the guests. So, we are starting Back to Reality. Here with me, I have Brother Muzaffar.
Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Wa alaikum, it's a
pleasure and honor
happy
to be here.
To you. And also Sister Sadiqa, welcome to your show.
Thank you for having
welcome
me.
Welcome to your program.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here with you all.
This is a pleasure to be with you too. And we are going to discuss some very interesting stuff in today's session. Okay, are you forgiving people?
Forgiving people?
Yes. You forgive people easily?
I'd like to think so. I try to.
Oh, you try to? Yeah. What about you, sister?
Initially, not at all.
It is
a difficult task to forgive those who hurt us.
Same in here.
But that's mainly after a lot of looking into myself.
Mm-hmm.
I came up with the conclusion, a lot of the times, it's mainly ego. He hurt me. She hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to forgive. And, it ruined my life for one. Mm-hmm. And then when I started to look into other people as human beings rather than just me versus them.
Yes.
My life became much more peaceful. I felt much more peace with myself because I saw the other person just as me, able to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. We don't always hurt others with evil intentions.
Exactly.
We hurt them out of, sometimes it's just a mistake. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we're in that specific situation where we make the wrong choices. So yes, no, I was not initially forgiving, but having talked to a lot of teachers, I came to the conclusion a lot of the times it is a very big ego issue, which unfortunately a lot of us struggle with.
Exactly. Well, I don't think I'm that much forgiving, but also I'm not that much so hard with that issue. I mean, I may forgive, but it's very difficult to forget. Isn't it right?
It's harder to forget.
Forgiving is easy, but forgetting is very difficult.
Forgetting is very difficult, but that's what it's really about, to be able to let go and actually forget. Forgiving is not enough. It's almost superficial.
Well, there must be some strategies to do that.
Of course, yeah, there are.
You have to work on yourself a lot and a lot.
It goes back to what Sister Sadiqa was saying. It's actually quite wise what she said.
Mm-hmm.
You often feel like you're being attacked by people, and it is a lot to do with your own ego. If you go and look in the Quran, you're going to find the roadmap for so many problems and roadblocks that we encounter in life. And one of them is this.
Mm-hmm.
One of the verses which really helped me with this is the verse which says, وَمَنْ كَانَ يُرِيدُ الْعِزَّةَ فَلِلَّهِ عِزَّةُ جَمِيعًا. One who desires honor or respect. Mm-hmm. Well, Allah's is honor entirely. Honor itself belongs to Allah entirely. A lot of the time, without realizing it, when we are offended or when we feel like somebody's done some sort of injustice to us,
mm-hmm.
we lash out at them. Because we feel like our honor, our respect has been degraded. You see, that's where the ego
yes.
comes into it. But if we really recognize that all izzah is actually Allah's anyway,
mm-hmm.
right? And He gives it to whoever He pleases, then this problem won't be such a problem anymore.
Well, actually, putting that into practice is the most difficult part of the story.
Right.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Well, I know that I'm a human being. I know that others are just like me. They are prone to doing mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes what they do to me can change the direction of my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
That is where exactly forgiving gets very difficult.
I was having a discussion with a youth the other day, and he said something really remarkable, which really stood out to me, which is often the case when you're talking to youths.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this is not Youth Station. This is Back to Reality.
Yes, but we can use some parts that are related to youth.
But what he said was, look, if anybody gets offended at something, it's mm-hmm. because they feel like there is some truth behind what was said.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yeah.
So, for example.
So, you're telling the truth into my face. You're throwing it to my face.
Yeah. Otherwise, if you had no feeling that there's some mm-hmm. truth behind that insult or behind whatever that person just said,
yes.
if you weren't feeling that, then you wouldn't feel insecure about it.
Following
if you're not insecure about it, you won't be hurt by it. You
yes.
won't be offended by it.
Yes, sister.
Following up on Brother Muzaffar's mm-hmm. point about forgetting and izzah from Allah, a lot of the times it also goes back after our ego. Maybe our ego can stop us from forgiving others. But when it comes to forgetting, sometimes it does come down to another unfortunate point within our souls, and that's arrogance, because we feel that Izzah is from our souls, as the brother Muzaffar mentioned, that we forget that Allah is the one who gives it to us, because we see ourselves as independent from Allah, which is another problem that we struggle with a lot. We know that as Muslims, and this is one of the fundamental points in our belief system, is that we rely on Allah constantly. Every second of our life, we are reliant on Allah. But when we forget these points, we start thinking we are independent of Allah. And therefore, when it comes to an issue like arrogance, we want to get our izzah from ourselves, not that Allah is the one who gives it to us. Which is why then it becomes a bit more difficult to forget, because now I see myself as being hurt without realizing that Allah is the one to mend
those breaks that have been imposed to us.
I mean, that was excellently explained. There might be many listeners out there who think that, well, seeing ourselves as connected to Allah, etc., these things seem very nice on paper, but it's all very theoretical.
Yes.
No, it's actually practical. If we actually digest this idea, we really take it into our hearts, not just in our minds, but in our hearts, it will free us in so many ways that we never expected it to free us before. Suddenly, you're not getting offended at what people are saying. Suddenly, it doesn't harm you anymore when people even insult you. Look at the example of the Ahlul Bayt.
But that does need many time. That does need growing. We have to grow older and older in order to learn some things. You know, when I was younger, I'm speaking of myself. When I was younger, I was just pretty much harder on these issues, you know. It was very difficult for me to forget things because sometimes people do some injustice into you that are very difficult to make up for.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? They maybe change your decisions. They maybe change. You make decisions based on whatever injustice that has been made to you. And then you're changed totally into another person. So we're just, now we were talking about the person who has to forgive. Now let's talk about the person who has done those wrong things to others. And now he or she seeks forgiveness. At the very first point, I would love to say that as human beings, we should consider that all mankind have got hearts. So these hearts are very easily breakable. So we should consider whatever words we say, because words are stronger than knives. They can kill you. Words are the most dangerous invention of human beings. So we should watch our words, we should watch our deeds more and more. Be careful, you know. People these days are becoming a little bit careless about what they do. Now I think it's time to go for a very short interval. After no minute, we'll be back.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Okay, so sister, following what we were talking about, can you talk a little bit about the person who has done the wrong things? Do you have any advices for those people?
First, there are two people over here. There's the one who did the wrong and the one who was at the receiving end of the wrongdoing. We need, each person has their own responsibility, right? So my responsibility to another person is not to hurt them. But if they hurt me and I'm on the receiving end of it, then each of us has been given a responsibility. My responsibility would be to, fine, if the person has hurt me and has sought forgiveness, I cannot go forward and say, I'm not going to forgive you, because on another day I will be at the same receiving end. Someone else might come forward and say, I'm not going to forgive you. As a community, we are supposed to help each other in progressing in our lives. By me not forgiving the other person, let's say this action could cause them to fall from a level in spirituality that they were trying to attain.
Yes, that
is very also
true.
Or maybe through this forgiveness, we have to help each other towards the dhuhr of the imam at the end of the day.
At least we can give them time.
At least not only time, you can
a
forgive
chance.
Them and allow their, not to become a barrier in their progress with their relationship with Allah at the end of the
then
day.
Then now that you're forgiven, where your anger goes?
Anger is an issue we can help ourselves with. Yes, there is that pain within the heart. But if we leave everything to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, one of the points that you mentioned was that someone may do wrong, but we would be at the receiving end, which means my life might get messed up.
Mm-hmm.
But then Allah is the best of planners. What she might have done or what he might have done towards me, God might create another course of life for me. Yeah. Like, I'll tell you a story from my own childhood, right? Mm-hmm. Everyone has family issues, right?
Exactly.
So there was some family issues.
Family dramas.
No, oh, we all have them.
Yes.
My parents decided to move away. My dad got very sick out of it. He decided to move away. And alhamdulillah, where he has reached today, I don't think he would ever reach there had he stayed in that same situation.
Mm-hmm.
That situation might have messed up his life temporarily,
mm-hmm.
but in the future, it took him to a better, better, better place where he's much more at peace, not only with himself, but with his whole family. So I'm not going to give the whole details of family dramas.
Yes, I know.
But what I'm trying to say is that someone might do something wrong, but if we rely on Allah, then Allah would carve out another...
He will mend it for us.
Yes, he would make another road for us.
Yes.
And we see this in the lives of the prophets a lot, where they were harassed by the people mm-hmm. of the community. But look where they are. Where are the communities? The people of Ad, the people of Thamud. We don't hear about them.
Allah would figure out the situation.
Yes, but today we hear about Prophet Ibrahim. We hear about Prophet Saleh. Look at Imam Ali. Mm-hmm. 200 years of cursing him.
Yes.
But look where he is today.
But very quickly, I just wanted to say that, look, when we're dealing with mu'mineen in particular, it's very, very dangerous for us to accidentally insult one of them, even by accident. There's a hadith that says that the mu'mineen, their hurma, their honor, their respect is greater than that of the Kaaba itself. Right.
Oh,
so meaning if you insult a mu'min thinking, oh, it's just a human being. No, no. If this is a mu'min, especially if it's a mu'min in reality, it's like you're insulting the Holy Kaaba, mm-hmm. that central symbol of Islam itself. So we have to be very, very careful when dealing with mu'mineen. Let's not, and this is advice for myself before anybody else, let's not insult them by accident, even.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Be very careful, tiptoe around the mu'min.
Well, now just to wrap it up, I would say a quote which is very beautiful, and one day at a time it captures my attention, and it says, one day there comes a time when people forget about whatever wrong you did to them, but they would never forget the feeling they had at that time. So be very careful about how you treat people. And as for forgiveness, you can practice that. There is no way we have to forgive, because also us as human beings need to be forgiven. So thank you for listening.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again let's become all again, proud again, 'cause I swear with firm belief in our hearts we can bring back the glory of our past. My Ummah, he will say, Rasulullah, even though we've strayed from him and his way. Look at where we were, look at where we are, tell me, is this how he'd wanted to be? Oh no, let's bring back our glory.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Though the impact is already being felt, heat waves are largely silent killers. Often, the toll is tallied far into the aftermath of an event and is vastly undercounted. Unlike wildfires and floods that produce immediate and visible destruction, heat waves' harmful effects can seem more subtle, even if they're in fact more deadly. Here we present you an article written by Gabrielle Cannon. The piece is titled California Debates Naming Heat Waves to Underscore Deadly Risk of Extreme Heat. Climate scientists from around the world issued dire warnings recently in the latest IPCC report on the dangers posed in the unfolding climate crisis. Among them is extreme heat, a crisis that on average already claims more American lives than hurricanes and tornadoes combined. Though the impact is already being felt, heat waves are largely silent killers. Often the toll is tallied far into the aftermath of an event and is vastly undercounted. Unlike wildfires and floods that produce immediate and visible destruction, heat waves' harmful effects can seem more subtle, even if they're in fact more deadly. Chrissy Ebbey, a professor in the Center for Health and the Global Environment at the University of Washington, says, "People don't think of heat as a hazard, but in the Pacific Northwest, where Ebbey lives, for example, unprecedented temperatures baked the region last year, bewildering residents used to moderate, often lukewarm summers." Policymakers and environmentalists are looking for better ways to close the gap in the public's perception of the risks of heat waves, especially in the American West, where landscapes are rapidly warming. Some are pushing for new ranking systems to help elevate awareness around the issue or assign heat waves names, much like federal agencies do for hurricanes. Kathy Bogman-McLeod, the Senior Vice President and Director of the Adrienne Ash Rockefeller Foundation Resilience Center, said, "We need a shock to the system. The organization, which focuses on policy solutions to the climate crisis, has advocated heat wave naming along with number categories as a way to add urgency to the growing disasters." She says, "If you go into the hospital now and are suffering from heat, they will say you have kidney failure or heart failure." She added, "There are so many areas now we need to culturally shift that context of heat." The group advised California on new legislation introduced last year, which would make it the first state to implement a naming and ranking system, like the organizational system for categorizing storms dating back in the 1800s. Athens, Greece, and Seville, Spain will roll out similar programs later on this year. Advocates of the program believe assigning a name to a disaster will help people engage with it. Kathy Bogman-McLeod said, "It becomes an identity and a brand is built, adding that it also helps for archival purposes. McLeod noted, "We all remember what happened during Hurricane Sandy. I know what a Category 3 is, and I know when it has a name, it has reached a certain threshold, and I need to pay attention and act. Still, the science isn't clear on whether a name would do much to communicate heightened dangers in the most effective way." Kimberly McMahon, a National Weather Service Public Weather Services program manager, said, "The National Weather Service is not aware of any research or evidence that suggests naming heat waves would raise awareness about heat-related risks." But she said early warning systems, with or without associated names, play an important part, adding, "Even knowing the potential for a heat event or abnormally hot summer can allow preparations to occur further in advance." Naming aside, the two bills in California also outlined the creation of an interagency heat task force, an extreme heat advisory council, and will open a new chief heat officer role to oversee planning and preparation. The pieces of legislation, if they pass, would initiate statewide advance warning and ranking by the start of 2024 and would establish the Extreme Heat and Community Resilience Program to coordinate state efforts and coordinate with local and regional officials. Chrissy Ebbey, a professor in the Center for Health and the Global Environment at the University of Washington, says that coordination between agencies that include local, state, and federal programs will be key. Noting that a variety of stakeholders should be brought to the table, Chrissy Ebbey says, "There are lots of opportunities to facilitate the information transfer so that as people develop these systems, they don't start from the very beginning." She added, "On the one hand, the projections are dire, but on the other, we have an enormous basket of options for what can be done to protect people who are at higher risk during a heat wave." Several municipalities across Western United States and governments across the globe are already adopting heat programs and heat plans. At the federal level, the National Integrated Heat Health Information Systems and White House Extreme Heat Intra-Agency Working Group are collaborating to expand messaging about extreme heat and offering up lessons learned. Phoenix, which is at the top of the list of rapidly heating cities, hired scientist and the heat expert David Hondula to head its new Office of Heat Response and Mitigation in September of last year, becoming the first U.S. city to launch a publicly funded position of this kind. Miami, Florida also brought on a chief heat officer, as did Athens, Greece, and Freetown in Sierra Leone. There's still a difficult path ahead, but according to Kirsty Ebbey, planning will go a long way. She said, "All heat-related deaths are preventable. We have a real opportunity to improve lives today, even if the climate continues to change." Meanwhile, Southern California, home to 23 million people, has largely been spared the kind of extreme fire escalation experienced in the northern part of the state. But models drawn up by researchers at the University of California at Los Angeles have predicted that will change. Wildfires in Southern California are often driven by dry winds, low humidity, and high temperatures, and the climate crisis is creating the perfect conditions for them to burn hotter, faster, and more frequently. Analyzing data from 49 climate stations scattered across the southern coast, from Santa Barbara to San Diego, the University of California at Los Angeles study found that the region could see double the number of what scientists call large fire days by 2100 if greenhouse gas emissions are not curbed. Even in a more moderate scenario, where heating is slowed, the researchers' models showed a 60% increase in high-risk days compared with the late 20th century. Glenn MacDonald, a professor of geography at University of California at Los Angeles and the lead author of the study, said, "Things are going to get worse." The researchers analyzed a series of variables that can increase fire risk and found certain climatic characteristics, especially how dry the air is, usually determine when the biggest blazes erupt. MacDonald said, "From what we found, that you could sort of predict when you were going to have your large fire probability in Southern California." After determining the patterns most associated with wildfires, researchers modeled how those patterns might change in the decades ahead. They found that not only will days get drier, but those days will start to show up earlier in the spring and stick around later into the autumn, thus extending the probability to a greater part of the year. They found these high-risk days would probably increase from the 36 days a year documented from the 1970s to the late 1990s to 71 days a year by 2070. These conditions won't just produce more wildfires, they will also affect fire behavior, making them more destructive and harder to contain. Southern California's landscapes, which are dominated by grassland and shrubland rather than large forests, burn and recover differently from their northern neighbors. Decades of poor land management and tamping down on indigenous practices of prescribed burnings has also left Northern California's forests overcrowded and primed for bad burns, an issue that's less prevalent in Southern California. MacDonald says that's partly why the region have had such different experiences with wildfires. It's not like climatologically we have been dodging the bullet, but we just haven't seen the same impact that we see in the more remote regions of Northern California and the Sierra Nevada in those forested systems. That doesn't mean the rest of the state will be spared. A separate study released last year, led by researchers at University of California at Irvine, looked at the temperatures in the Sierra Nevada range during 450 wildfires that ignited there between 2001 and 2020. The analysis shows that as warming gets worse and temperatures continue to spike, wildfires in Sierra Nevada could increase by 20% or more over the next 20 years. The amount of land burnt would increase even more sharply, rising by 25% by the 2040s. Fires are already exhibiting more extreme behavior, adding new challenges to containment efforts. One new phenomenon documented in a study published recently and led by MacDonald's colleagues at University of California at Los Angeles is blazes are more likely to burn throughout the night. The study found that globally, night fires have grown 7.2% in intensity over the last two decades, thanks to hot, dry conditions that persist after sunset, closing what was once an essential window to tame the flames of wildfire.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.